Welcome to another relay of Sovereign Mind Radio, where we explore the nature of the game, the game players, and many of the strategies in place that seem to keep us spellbound and distracted. I'm your host, Sonia Barrett, and thank you for joining me for another adventurous hour of transformative information, where informed guests continue to bring insight to the silent side of corporations, spiritual concepts, science, and technology as we examine the manner in which they influence our choices. Before introducing my guest, I want to bring to your attention an article titled Silent Sound, The Antithesis of Freedom. I am actually going to read just the intro to the article written by the editor of Educate Yourself, and it's very timely, so I just thought I would share this. Editor's notes, it says, this is an extremely timely and important essay. It overviews a secret Pentagon psychotronics technology known as Silent Sound Spread Spectrum, SSSS, that has been fully operational since the early 1990s. This technology was used against battle-hardened Iraq troops fortified in deep underground bunkers in Kuwait and Iraq in the first Gulf War in January of 1991. The physical, emotional, and psychological effects of this technology were so severe that hundreds of thousands of Iraqi troops surrendered en masse without firing even a single shot against U.S.-led coalition forces. The numbers reported in the news were staggering. 75,000 and then another 125,000 or more Iraqi troops would come out of their deep desert bunkers waving white flags and falling to their knees before approaching U.S. troops and literally kiss their captors' boots or hands if given the opportunity. Why would 8-year veterans of Middle Eastern warfare with Iran 1980 through 1988 behaved this way? Simple. They were subjected to a technology that was so extreme and incomprehensible that they were suddenly reduced to the level of compliant children and felt grateful to still be alive in the wake of their mind-wrenching experience. This technology is about to be used, albeit in a more subtle fashion, against American citizens in a highly classified and covert operation to mind control and manipulate the entire population into compliance with our new world order overlords. The technology will utilize a combination of HARP transmitters, Gwen towers, microwave cell phone towers, and the soon-to-be mandatory high-definition digital TV that will enter your home via cable, satellite, HDTVs, or those oh-so-easy-to-obtain digital converter boxes that the government is so anxious to help you obtain and underwrite most of the cost on your behalf. Well, I would strongly suggest reading this article as it isn't about fear. I don't ever feel that it's about fear, but I do believe that it is always about being well-informed. You may visit the link to this article and many other such articles by visiting our New Corporate Body magazine's website at www.newcorporatebody.com, as well as to subscribe to the New Corporate Body magazine. Okay, so we're moving on to our guest. Well, today's guest is Greg Roach, a lifelong student of comparative religion and spirituality. Greg had a visionary experience of the transcendent unity behind all creation during a pilgrimage to Egypt in 1997. Subsequently, he answered Spirit's call to offer initiatory pilgrimages to like-minded souls, building on 10 years of sacred travel in Egypt, the Holy Land, Greece, France, Scotland, America, Bali, Eastern Europe, and England. He also podcasts both Meditations for America and Spirit of Place. In the esoteric world, Greg holds an MFA in directing and is a successful entrepreneur and inventor who holds multiple patents. Well, I would like to welcome you to the show. Greg, are you with us?
I am indeed. Good morning, everyone.
All right. It sounds like you're coming through loud and clear.
That's a relief. I made sure that I found a place to park where I had five bars.
Well, we are just happy that you were able to go ahead and be with us. So I appreciate that. You know, you have such an amazing background in terms of just even the travel aspect, just being so many places, the amazing ability to, you know, have the international sacred tour company called Spirit Quest, and you've been gifted with Meditations for America, which we're going to go into all of that a little later on. But what I'd like to know is I'd like to know a bit more about your arrival at this place in your life. You've undergone some challenging circumstances in your life, as, you know, we all have, but some, I do believe, you know, more intense than others. What was the defining moment then, or moments, that brought you to this place where you were able to find some sort of solace or purpose?
Well, the defining moment for me, absolutely, was that experience in Egypt where suddenly the veil was pulled aside and I stood in the presence of pure living unity consciousness, of pure mind. And, you know, the analogy that just came to my little mind as you were speaking was, for me, it was a little like being in the middle of a dead sleep. And suddenly a flash grenade going off in your room and all the lights being turned on and the stereo blaring and, you know, and suddenly you go from this lovely little cocoon of unconsciousness, which is essentially how I had lived my life prior to that point, despite my self-illusion that that was not the case, to suddenly being just forced into, a state of wakefulness. And for years after that, trying to go back to sleep and not being able to, not being, you know, allowed to, both by internal forces and by external forces. And so it's been an interesting and bumpy road during, you know, the subsequent 10 years now since that occurred to me, you know, struggling to really hold on to that place of consciousness and that place of awareness and to look through the illusions that we are just constantly surrounded by, and that in particular the armatures of our modern Western life are designed to further. You know, that's one of the things that I really respect about what you're doing with the show and what other people in this space are doing. You know, the work to help to wake us as a collective up to the ways in which we are being, you know, manipulated.
Absolutely.
And so I think those analogies of sleep and wakefulness function on many levels. You know, for me, my entree into this awareness was this kind of forceful, almost traumatic birth experience. And, you know, one of the things that flowed from that was a number of years of deep depression. As I tried to wrestle with, man, geez, what happened to me? What was that? What do I do with it? You know? What's it mean? Why me? And all of these kinds of things. And now, thankfully, I have come through the other side of that, you know, thanks to a number of things, the support of my, you know, life partner, Hallie, who has stayed by my side throughout this whole dark period, input of a number of spiritual disciplines and spiritual leaders, and, you know, my own determination ultimately to get through it and to transmute it for myself. So now I'm in a place of high blessing and much gratitude, you know, and indeed my mission of sharing the world's sacred places and sacred traditions and sacred sites with people who want to go and experience them, or even people that can't go but still want to experience them, is the way that I've chosen to kind of focus the outcome of what happened to me, you know, those 10 years ago.
No, I think one of the interesting and humorous things that you said is the trying to go back to sleep.
Yeah, well, we all want to be able to hit that snooze button, you know. As a matter of fact, just this morning, I got up extra early so I could make sure the driveway is shoveled, I can get the car out, you know. And so the alarm goes off at 7, I'm like, oh, okay. 10 more minutes, I could spare that. You know, it's the most natural thing in the world. But that phenomenon, again, happens at every level, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it sort of brings to mind, real quickly, a story I kind of remembered this morning. I remember my younger son being extremely upset with his older brother when, you know, his older brother liked to sort of, you know, taunt him to some degree. You know how that is. And
yeah, being an older brother, yes, I know this phenomenon.
And he said Christmas, you know, that the whole thing, Santa Claus, all of that wasn't real. Well, my younger son knew that, but he got upset because he didn't want his brother to tell him that. So that was what he was upset about. He wasn't upset that it wasn't real. He just didn't want to be reminded. And so he was very upset about it. He was probably about 5 or 6 because he enjoyed the fantasy of it.
Yeah,
and very symbolic of you know, us on this ride. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, that's a beautiful analogy, you know, for what we all go through on a more conscious level, you know, when
right.
it comes to the media and the news and hearing things about what's really going on in the world and going, no. You know, let me hold on to this fantasy for a little while longer. So.
I don't want to know. But I tell you, when you don't know, whew. Yeah, when you know, it also can be just a lot of work because you end up having to be so responsible for yourself, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think that's always seems to be the fear.
Yeah. But, no, and that's the perfect word for it. From knowledge and awareness flows responsibility. You know,
first
you have responsibility for yourself for maintaining that discipline and mental hygiene to not drift back off this, to not fall back into the fantasy. You know, and the illusion. But then also I think that, you know, the more time you spend in that awakened state, as much as any of us can actually achieve it, you begin to feel a responsibility for humanity, you know, for those around you to help to, you know, to communicate and to wake everybody else up, which I know
right.
is, you know, the path that you're on.
Right.
You know, and again, I salute that. That's terrific. We need more of it in the world.
Well, what I want to ask, you know, is because you are it's so amazing looking at some of your information on Egypt. I wanted to say, basically, what would you say, then, that you are more strongly drawn to Egypt? Of all the places that you've toured and spent time, what is it, would you say, then, about Egypt that seems to draw you, if that is the ultimate draw? Because you've been to many places.
I have, yeah. That's been one of the blessings of this past 10 years. And you know, at first, this kind of travel and seeking out these places and these experiences was a little like a soporific drug because it eased the pain that I was in.
Yeah. Mm.
But then eventually that transmuted itself, and I began to realize the power in these places, which was what I was being drawn to, you know, initially.
Right.
And, you know, then, again, awakened to this larger calling of sharing these things with other people. But, yes, I would have to say, while I have many favorite places across the planet, and I've been to many powerful and beautiful spots, some of them just purely natural locations, others of them, you know, a combination of nature and man-made structures. There is something that is particularly potent about Egypt. And you can see this in a number of regards. You know, first of all, if you just do a quick survey of, it doesn't matter, the average person on the street, and you say, where is the place on the planet that you would most like to go to, or are most interested in, Egypt is invariably going to be at the top of that list, if not in the number one, you know, spot. There's such a mystery about it. Now, a lot of that has to do with kind of the trappings of what we know about pharaonic culture and these tremendous temples and the pyramids and the Sphinx and these kinds of things. You know, you flip through the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, you know, these kinds of venues and outlets. Egypt is a perennial. You know, Egypt and sharks seem to be, you know, evergreens for these guys.
Right.
But then when you go and you experience it, you know, first of all, you're struck by the exotic nature of a country with such a tremendous history to it. And, you know, one of the things that, that I like to remind people of is we tend to think of ourselves as being the inheritors of the Greco-Roman cultural and kind of mental tradition. You know, we think that, that so much of the underpinnings of our culture have came from the Greeks and then subsequently the Romans. But the Greeks in their day were an infant nation relative to the Egyptians. Mm. Every significant Greek philosopher studied in Egypt. And, you know, there's a famous quote where a Greek philosopher said, "We are but children compared to the Egyptians." Mm. And so, in truth, so many of the underpinnings of our cultural, religious traditions come from the Egyptians. Everything from the structure of our society, just at a very basic level, in terms of how things are divided into states and then counties and, you know, cities. Egypt was structured in an identical way. You know, there's no accident, for instance, that we have a pyramid on our, on our money.
Absolutely.
But then, you know, there's a deeper, more profound influence in Egypt, and that is the energetic effect from the land itself.
Right.
And so, you know, as I've been studying sacred sites, I came to the realization, because my first interface with these places was purely personal and emotional. I'd go there to feel the place and to feel better as a result. Mm. And then eventually I began to perceive, well, this is a sacred place because the energy here is different, special, you know, more powerful, more focused than some other place. And I began to realize when, as I researched the history of these places, that they had, you know, they're like pearls. And that, you know, you're looking at Shark Cathedral, for instance, or the Temple of Karnak, but that underneath is something older, and that underneath that is something even older. And I think that if we could go down to the seed of that pearl, we would find, you know, the equivalent of a little grain of sand that was just a pile of stones that some extremely, I can't say a primitive person, because that's a misnomer. And, and that's a kind of intellectual, colonialism, you know, temporal colonialism that we in the modern world like to practice. But an ancient person, when they would have felt this energy, this flow of power between heaven and earth, and they'd respond to it, and they would express that in some way by building a little shrine. And then over the years, that shrine became a place of worship and focus and, you know, altered consciousness and increased awareness. And then it became a chapel. And, you know, and then thousands of years later, you end up with a great pyramid or a Temple of Karnak or a Shark Cathedral.
So I think it's so awesome. Yeah, I think what you're saying is extremely awesome in the sense when you just said, mentioned primitive people, and then you changed your mind on that, I think that's such an important factor because those ancients then that we would have called primitive, they were so much more in touch with the earth, with those energies. And yet we find ourselves feeling that we are what we would call extremely evolved, yet we seem to be more detached. Well, of course, you know, we know it's part of the process, but in the sense of really just examining that, it's really interesting because now we are excited in feeling as if we're discovering something new because we are now, being drawn back to nature, where these people, that was how they lived.
Absolutely. Yes, I completely agree. I mean, you know, first of all, if you just consider the fact that biologically modern humans have been on the planet for several hundreds of thousands of years, at a minimum, you know, I mean, and nobody really knows exactly what those precise parameters are, but at a minimum, 200,000, 250,000 years, perhaps going back hundreds of thousands of years beyond that. You know, culture in the orthodox conception of it, you know, dates from roughly around between 4,000 and 5,000 BC. Well, that's a pretty shallow breath relative to that greater expanse of time. And so, you know, the idea that because we don't have the kind of sophisticated artifacts and remnants from those earlier periods of time, that we, as humans, were ignorant savages.
Right.
Again, it's a kind of temporal intellectual, you know, imperial thinking that negates the fundamental truth of who and what the human race is.
Right.
And it's interesting. You're absolutely right. You know, there's been this reflowering, this renaissance, in just the last few decades, certainly since, you know, the time of this theosophist, so, you know, maybe a century or so.
Right.
Where we're
right.
recapturing this older awareness. And it's often called, you know, ancient wisdom, new thought, or new thought, ancient wisdom. And indeed, if you look at the Renaissance phenomenon in Europe, when they were uncovering and recovering and recapturing what was to them quite old and lost, the knowledge of the quote-unquote ancient world, ancient cultures, and the excitement that was engendered as a result of that, I do feel that in a spiritual sense, we're going through a similar phenomenon now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of our challenges is, can we find a way for this spiritual reflowering to outpicture into the external world? It happened in the Renaissance in a number of ways. Where this recovered knowledge, you know, was outpictured and expressed in the physical world and in the structure of society. And, you know, one of our challenges is, as we go through this internal renaissance, can we find a way to bring our larger external world into alignment with that? And, you know, I think there are a number of forces that are arrayed against us, unfortunately. Forces that are, you know, locked in a very deep commitment to their own personal interests.
Right.
And, you know, and that takes the form of the corporatocracy
mm-hmm.
that, you know, surrounds us and penetrates our mind with a constant barrage of values and images to keep us locked in that mm-hmm. hypnosis, to keep us locked in that asleep state.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, the bells and the whistles and the, you know, flashing lights, and it's, you know, it's presented in a manner in which it hypnotizes people.
Absolutely, yeah.
But
well,
go ahead, Greg, and then I want
to... Well, I was going to say, this is one of the reasons why I find this kind of conscious travel, and that's maybe even a better word than, say, spiritual travel or certainly religious travel, but conscious travel, to be a useful and powerful tool for waking people up.
Right.
You know, just on a mundane kind of cultural level, when you go mm-hmm. and you really, truly interface with people living in a very different way, and you connect fundamentally with their humanity, you come back to, you know, America, for instance, since that's where most of our companions and travelers come from, you come back to America with a whole different perspective on the world and on life here. And that is, in itself, a very healthy, constructive, positive thing. But there's something that happens that's much deeper and much more powerful, and this is one of the things that I find that's unique about Egypt. Not singular about Egypt, because I've experienced it in a lot of different places, but the energy field in Egypt seems to have a degree of concentration to it, that when you're in these places there, the quickening that happens in your psyche, in your spiritual body, in your perceptions is greatly, greatly accelerated over, you know, many other places. And then also, I believe that there was a spiritual technology that was understood and practiced by the ancients, not just the ancient Egyptians. I'm a firm believer in the idea of a worldwide precursor civilization.
Right.
And I think Egypt was the inheritor of a lot of this knowledge.
Right.
And these days, we've lost, you know, this information.
Yes, I'm trying to regain it. And to go back to that, because I want to, well, we're going to stay in Egypt here for a little bit, but you used the word flowering, so of course that reminded me of this question I wanted to ask. The geometric design of the flower of life is obviously said to be found in a number of the pyramids, and of course the flower of life is said to symbolize the origin of the universe. And would you shed some light on this for me, Greg?
Yeah, absolutely. The flower of life very specifically was my entryway into this whole world. So I went to Egypt as a tourist who was dead asleep in my personal life. I went to a place called Abydos, which is one of the oldest sites in Egypt and which was a pilgrimage site for the ancient Egyptians going all the way back into their earliest prehistory. I went to a place called the Osirian. Now, in the interest of time, I won't go into all the facts and issues around the Osirian, but it's a big anomaly. There are many anomalies in Egypt, but the Osirian is one of them, and it's one of these data points that doesn't fit the orthodox concept about the age of culture and, you know, et cetera. So it definitely directs us back to a much more ancient time for a variety of reasons. And inscribed on the walls of the Osirian is the symbol of the flower of life, which is a series of interlocking circles. And it's the visual representation of, many, many different fundamental laws of the universe. But one of them is this kind of irrational, recursive thing, like the phi ratio or pi. These they're called irrationals because they're things that can be calculated into infinity. So once you start creating the symbolic structure, the geometric structure of the flower of life, this thing just perpetuates itself out forever and ever. So I go. My guide shows me these carvings. They're not even carvings, actually. We don't really know how it was done because it's as if the symbol has been tattooed into the stone, which is one of the other mysteries about the place. So he shows this to me and he says, he actually misspoke and referred to it as the tree of life, which of course is something from the Kabbalah, but ironically, the tree of life fits perfectly into the flower of life. Again, I didn't know any of this, so I'm like, snap some pictures. Long story short, I go upstairs, I walk into a shaft of sunlight in a room in the temple, which is, streaming down from a hole in the ceiling. It hits me in the face, and I am completely transported out of my mundane reality, my mundane perception, and I am in the presence of, again, this pure, living, loving mind. And to my inner sight, it took the form of the geometry of the flower of life, this still, rendered symbol that I've just seen, only now it is infinite, recursive, intelligent mental fire falling and collapsing and being reborn in every, moment. And so this was the thing that at first when I get back, I'm like, what the hell was that? What? All right? So then I start researching the flower of life and sacred geometry, and I get introduced to the work of Drunvalo Melchizedek and a lot of other people that was just starting to come into the consciousness, coincidentally, right around the same time that I had this experience. And so for me, personally, nobody else can have this, of course, but it's a tremendous validation point because I didn't know anything about any of this stuff.
That's what I love, though. That, to me, that is one of the most fascinating things is, I mean, and that's been my experience, is the beauty of having no clue about something and getting this amazing revelation, which then, you know, you're then directed to other information to support the fact that you weren't crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Exactly. And so then as you uncover these things, you go, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, that one's not quite so right, but you know, and so in a nutshell, sacred geometry in general.
Greg, 1 second, just before you go any further, I want to make sure that, if anybody just tuned in, we are listening to Greg Roach and you are listening to Sovereign Mind Radio. And my guest is Greg Roach with Spirit Quest Tours and as well as Meditations for America. Okay, continue, Greg.
Well, so what I was saying was that sacred geometry in the broad sense and the flower of life in the particular sense is a way of representing the fundamental underlying laws of the universe and nature as a series of, you know, kind of geometric relationships and ratios and patterns. And so in a way, you can think of the flower of life as being the blueprint of creation. It's the pattern through which and by which light and consciousness coalesces into matter.
Right.
And so this is something that, you know, in the world of quantum physics and our advanced technical knowledge, you know, we're beginning to uncover these truths through the use of instrumentation, for instance, and the scientific method. But it's something that has been available to the mystic and to the mystic inner awareness and inner sight for millennia or longer, which is one of the reasons why we can't just conveniently discount those ancient, you know, humans, you know, people living 100,000 years ago as being ignorant savages, because they had the same inner capacity that we do to see beyond the veil, to look into the heart of creation and realize that there is one thing, there's one life, there's one mind, there's one substance in the world. Call it God, call it divinity, call it whatever you want. I am it and you are it.
Right.
And we are its instruments to see and experience and express. And so that's the great gift that you know, these disciplines, the sacred geometry and the flower of life, that's the ultimate implication of these things.
Right. When understood, you know, yes, when understood. And again, the beauty about truth is that it's not that what you know right now isn't what we call true. It's just that it's forever unfolding. And I think that's what we, you know, like a flower. It's forever just, you know, blooming more and more. So I think it's up to the individual as to just how far you want to go with allowing that truth to expand, or, you know, if you choose to limit it as well. And we see that a lot. People come to a place where that becomes the absolute, and they don't get to see, you know, you're always, I mean, is there a core, you know, is there a core? But the thing is to continue to go as deeply as you can.
Absolutely.
So I think, important.
I think there's a lot that's happening in the popular consciousness right now to kind of remind people of that, because immediately what sprang to my mind as you were speaking was, you know, the red pill or the blue pill, you know, well, okay, that's great entertainment, but it's also profoundly important, you know,
yes,
the awareness that we have this choice and that we have to make that choice. And we do make that choice whether we know it or not, you know.
We do.
Yeah.
Greg, I want to ask you about the temples. Now, I guess in a lot of your presentations, you talk about this. You talk about the temples, in reference to the dedication of the temples to divinities, which are comparable to the chakras, stating that we move up the Nile, we move up the Nile, we move up the subtle energy system, and perhaps you could go a bit into the significance of the Nile in spirituality.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the Nile, first of all, in a physical biological sense, it's very much like a human spine. It is a tremendous energy channel and energy conduit. And if you look at it, you know, the Nile actually does resemble a spine in that it runs in, you know, pretty much a straight line. It's unusual that it runs south to north. And then it gets to the delta and it flowers out, you know, just like our brains do. So in terms of the body of the land of Egypt, you know, the Nile has that same kind of function, and the ancient Egyptians always associated the Nile with life, because unlike many, you know, most other places in Egypt, you have this very clear delineation between life and death. You know, there are places where the strip of life next to the Nile is literally a few yards wide. And then it's like there's been a line drawn, and you go from green to brown. And the desert in that part of the world is not like, you know, if you're used to, say, the deserts in the Southwest here in the States. We have our deserts are still tremendously alive. These deserts are profoundly desert. Rock, sand, stone, and nothing else, you know?
Right.
So first of all, from a physical, biological sort of a point of analogy, the Nile is very much like the spinal column of the human body and energy system. And then placed along the Nile are a variety of temples that are dedicated to different Egyptian divinities or gods, the Netters, the ancient Egyptians called them. And so there is a direct correspondence between these temples, the energy frequency of the divinity that is, you know, being worshipped at that temple, and the eastern chakra systems and the qualities of those chakras. Now, the ancient Egyptians never talked about chakras. They never characterized these things as chakras. But again, just as you were saying, you know, there's an underlying truth to the world that can be expressed and understood in a variety of different ways. And so in just the same way that all religions are, you know, roads up the side of a mountain and any one of them will get you to the top, you know, the system that the ancient Egyptians used was addressing this fundamental underlying truth in a different way than was the Eastern system of the chakras. But once you become aware of the analogies between the two and you start to map them out and you go, oh yeah, the temple of Isis at Philae, that's the root chakra, that's birth. The temple of Kamambo, which is the only temple in Egypt that's dedicated to two different gods simultaneously, Horus, who is the falcon, who's the solar principle and who is a very Christ-like figure, and Sobek, who is a crocodile, who's that, you know, that dark, and that's the sacral chakra, and this is where we go from unity into duality, and the duality that's inherent in creation, and the conflict between light and dark that is also inherent in creation. Then we move up to a temple that's dedicated purely to Horus and the solar plexus. And so this is where we master those forces, and where we go from the battle of duality, and we conquer, you know, these dark forces in the world and in ourselves. And there's a whole Egyptian mythological cycle that's the passion of Isis and Osiris that has
right.
to do with Set killing his brother, usurping his throne, and then Horus, the sun, coming along and setting things right, defeating his uncle, returning land to, you know, the reign of good, and returning balance to the universe. And from that point, I'm creating an incredibly shorthanded version
of a
very important myth. And then from that point on, every pharaoh became the living Horus. And so at the Temple of Horus, this is where the cycle of Horus battling and besting Set is communicated and, you know, played out in stone. And one of the things that the Egyptians realized was that this evil, this set force inside of us and in the world, can't be killed. It can only be mastered. It can be defeated, but it's still there. And so
right.
we have to remain constantly vigilant to this truth.
And I think that's important, Greg. I'm always sticking a pin in whatever. Everything you're saying is important, but there are things that you're saying that hold a lot of symbology, because when you just said that it's not about getting rid of, and I think we have a tendency to want to get rid of, and it really isn't. And you said mastering that, and that brings to mind balance. That's what it brings to mind for me, because we tend to want to be this thing or that thing. And I think in the overall picture, it's about a balance. And in that balance, there is no concern about, you know, being good or bad, because you're simply in an aligned process. So you don't have to worry about doing anything that is going to be imposing on another human being.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. And we have to constantly remind ourselves that every light casts its shadow. You know, that we can't have one without the other. And so our choice is, well, where along that spectrum are we going to choose to reside? Then once we've mastered these forces, again, in terms of our journey up the Nile and experiencing these temples, we pass through the solar plexus, which is this engine that, you know, where our will to change gets affected. This great sun inside of us that corresponds both to our physical sun and to the great sun at the center of all existence. And so once we've passed through that, then we can move into the higher realms of love, self-expression, true sight, and ultimately ascension and transcendence.
Right.
And
absolutely.
So there are a number of sites that correspond to the heart. And in just the same way that, you know, we have multiple heart chakras, because there are different forms of love. There's, you know, agape love for our fellow man. There's eros, etc. There are temples that are dedicated to each of these different qualities and expressions of love. Then we move into the throat and the self-expression, again, which is in Abydos. We move up finally to the third eye in a place called Saqqara. And it's interesting, you know, again, the Egyptians had this tremendously powerful and profound symbolic system.
I was just about to mention that. I'm glad you said that, because it is all about symbology. They use less words than we do, which causes more confusion.
Absolutely, yeah. And so for us, it's a lot of it is really impenetrable. We look at these symbols and we go, what the hell, you know? What's that all about, you know? But to them, it communicated profound truths.
Oh, yeah, it was more powerful.
Yeah, well, exactly. And that's one of the other things about being in these places. You know, we are awakened on so many levels. We're like icebergs, you know. Most of us, the bulk of us, is really kind of below the waterline.
Right.
And you know, so the conscious mind finds an appeal in these places. But the conscious mind is also kind of befuddled by them.
Mm-hmm.
But the deeper levels of us, the deeper levels of our energetic beings are being enlivened and awakened and, you know, lit up. I mean, the switches are just being, you know, flipped
absolutely. I love that.
And I was going to say, part of it is confronting these symbols, you know, where your conscious mind is going, what? But on a deeper level, you're going, yeah, I get it, you know?
Right.
But so, you know, we see these images of pharaohs and Egyptian, well, the pharaohs with the uraeus, the cobra, on their brow, right over the third eye. Well, if you go to Saqqara, you see images of cobras everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so again, you know, there's a really profound truth that happens in that place, because the energy that they responded to and that they then built in sympathy with and to act as a focusing and resonating tool for, because that's one of the things about this spiritual technology that we no longer understand, is that their buildings were giant, you know, the temple structures were giant resonating chambers in harmony with these forces, both in the world and inside of us. Right. Which is why going into these places is, can be so, so powerful. And so Saqqara is a terrific example of that. You go to Saqqara, you see, first of all, a step pyramid that, that is shaped very much like a pine cone, like the pineal gland, you know, that's,
right.
that the esoteric world is conversant mm-hmm. with. It sits right behind the third eye. You see all of these images everywhere of these rearing cobras. And when you have the esoteric key, the hidden key, and you realize, ah, this site is about awakening that place mm-hmm. in the energetic body, that third eye, you know, in activating the pineal gland, and as a result, being able to see the world clearly. But it's only when we've been through that whole initiatory process of going from unity consciousness that is the fundament and actually our birthright into the illusion of duality that's inherent in creation, mastering the forces of darkness and division within ourselves, finding our ability to love, our ability to express ourselves, then our ability to look into the heart of things, and then from there comes transcendence and ascension.
Oh,
and
it's
so
beautiful.
It's mm-hmm. amazing. It's completely amazing. And because yeah. that's the spiritual journey that we are each on as individuals, that we as a culture are on, and that we as a race are on.
Right.
And
it's a dance.
It is a perfect dance. That's exactly right.
Dance.
And it is outpictured in stone.
Mm-hmm.
And these stone temples and monuments are in perfect harmony with this energy from the earth and with this energy inside of us. And so when you go through that process, consciously and awake to what you're doing and knowing why you're doing it and what it means, it is powerfully transformative.
Right.
And I feel so blessed, you know, to have been given this awareness and to have had people put into my life who have helped me to see this awareness and to piece this awareness together. And certainly I'm not the only person that's delivering this message.
Right, absolutely. But each person has their own unique delivery. You know, everybody comes with their own specific energy to, you know, to what they say, to the words that they use, or the manner in which they deliver it. And you deliver it beautifully. So,
thank you.
I'm grateful of that. You know, Greg, I have a lot of questions that I really do want to ask you, but I want to make sure before we do end up running out of time on the show, and I always say we never run out of time, but according to the Matrix clock.
That's right, exactly.
I wanted to make sure that you talk about Spirit Quest Tours, because I want you to express what it is that is different about Spirit Quest Tours and what one can experience, you know, some things that are done that are different.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. You know, we approach travel, again, from the point of view of consciousness. So, you know, the way to shorthand it is to say that we facilitate very unique, spiritually transformative tours to places like Egypt and Bali and China. We're in the process of adding this next year, and the Holy Land, and we have this wonderfully expanding, you know, palette of offerings. So we approach that proposition consciously, and we do that in a number of ways. One of the things that we do, first of all, is we're a green company. So we do carbon offsetting, and we, you know, encourage our travelers to join us in that, and we help people to figure out how to do that and give them the tools for that. We also work with local children's charities in all of our host countries. So we take a collection from all of our travelers, and we'll make a presentation at an orphanage or like with the Bali Children's Fund when we're on the ground in our host country. So that idea of sustainability is very, very important to us. But so then one of the most important things for us is to come into that place with a deep reverence and respect for the local traditions, the local culture, the local forms of worship. Now, in a place like Egypt, that's going to take the form of, you know, visiting some very special mosques and churches and synagogues and some unusual kinds of experiences that we can offer people there. Obviously the temples in Egypt are not active worship temples, so that's what we turn them into. We usually arrange private visits. So, for instance, all of our trips feature a private visit to the Great Pyramid and into the Sphinx enclosure. And so when we go to these places, we go in as pilgrims, as aspirants, as worshipers. Mm-hmm. And very specifically in Egypt, we do work that we refer to as the Way of Horus, where that transformative process that I described, you know, working our way up the chakras and up the temple systems, we have a whole series of expressive experiences. I'm a little, you know, kind of struggling for words here, that we take people through that connect them to that those energies, both inside and outside. If we go to a place like Bali, for instance, we go into Balinese temples, and for instance, we'll do a mandala pilgrimage oftentimes in Bali. We go in and we go as active worshipers in the Balinese way. So, we show people how to dress like a Balinese and how to pray like a Balinese go through and really give them the active experience of what that kind of worship is like. So we go in consciously with a great deal of respect for whatever the local traditions are, whether they're, you know, Muslim or Christian or Hindu or, you know, whatever the case may be. And we really try and immerse people in that. And also it's important to us that we get people out and get you in real contact with real people. Now, our trips typically feature, you know, very luxurious accommodations. Because I have no problem with indulging the physical side of things while we are cultivating the spiritual side of things. I don't think that those things are in conflict. Again, as long as we approach it, you know, consciously. But we don't just stay in, like, you know, high-end Western compounds. You know, we like to get out and really, truly experience the living vitality of a local culture. Oftentimes in kind of mundane ways. Well, how do they eat? How do they cook? How do they farm? You know,
right.
Those things are just as much an expression of that divine principle as, you know, the most high-minded temple or ceremony. And so then, from a spiritual point of view, we connect with the living vitality of the people's current worship, and then we also go into, you know, the history and the idea of a personally transformative pilgrimage experience.
It sounds wonderful. I'm ready to go.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. Let me tell you. It is such a blessing for me to be the guy that gets to do this and to share this.
I
gotta tell you, the most amazing people are drawn to our trips. And I have friends that I made on trips 5, 6, 7 years ago. You know, I still, hey, I'm in Atlanta, let's go to lunch, you know, and we exchange emails, and it's just a tremendous, tremendous
blessing. I love it. That's what I call, it's really and truly not just a job. It is an adventure.
Oh, yeah, that's what that slogan's all about.
Yeah, that's what it's all about. They took that from you. But I wanted to go into some other things, and, you know, but... Gosh, we're out of time. So, Greg, I'm going to have you come back on the show when you know, we'll schedule a time. We'll figure it out, because I wanted to go into Meditations of America, for America, and talk about some other things here, because I just think I love the way you present what you present. Would you give out your information for me, please, as to contacting you?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, so let me see, a couple of things. First of all, my company site is spiritquesttours.com. My personal blog, which is both about travel and spirituality, is at spiritquestworld.net. And then my channeled Meditations for America, which is about awakening the collective American consciousness, is at meditationsforamerica.com. And there are links to all of these, one from the other. So, you know, if you hit one of them, you can very quickly get out to, you know, to one of the others. And my personal email address is greg@spiritquesttours.com. So that's pretty straightforward. And please, I encourage, you know, anybody to get in touch with me. I love connecting with like-minded people that share these interests. And I would be honored to come back on the show. I mean, obviously there's a tremendous sympathy of, you know, belief and calling here, and I just think it's terrific what you're doing, and I'm, you know, very happy to contribute to it in some small way. So
thank you so much, Greg. Thank you. And to the listening audience, once again, thanks for joining me for another enlightening and intriguing show. And please join me next week at the same time for another quest in uncovering this great cosmic game. Visit the website www.sovereignmindradio.com to listen to the archive of the show and many others. Until next time, remember that the power to be a sovereign mind, a free mind, lies within you. Join me.